Access Cast, an Accessibility initiative, presents Unstoppable Mindset, the podcast where inclusion, diversity, and the unexpected meet. Hi, I'm Michael Hinkson, Chief Vision Officer for Accessibility and the author of the number one New York Times bestselling book, Thunderdog, the story of a blind man, his guide dog, and the triumph of trust. Thanks for joining me on my podcast as we explore our own blinding fears of inclusion, unacceptance, and our resistance to change. We will discover the idea that no matter the situation or the people we encounter, our own fears and prejudices often are our strongest barriers to moving forward. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is sponsored by Accessibility. That's ACCESSIBE. Visit www.accessibility.com to learn how you can make your website accessible for persons with disabilities and to help make the internet fully inclusive by the year 2025. Glad you dropped by. We're happy to meet you and to have you here with us. Hi, and welcome to another episode of Unstoppable Mindset, the podcast where inclusion, diversity, and the unexpected meet. And it is that. Today we have as our guest Tiffany Noel Brown, who has an interesting story to tell, lots of things to talk about. We'll spend a bunch of time today, I suspect, talking about diversity, inclusion, and we will see what else we come up with. So, Tiffany, welcome to Unstoppable Mindset.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here. I'm so privileged to be able to talk with you and really excited for your audience to try to think of, be included in this conversation even.
So tell me a little bit about kind of you from the beginning and what eventually got you into this whole area of diversity and inclusion?
Yes. So thank you for asking that. I am, even as a little kid, I remember I was treated differently. And I got a lot more attention. And I wasn't treated differently in a negative way, but in a positive way. And it actually made me really uncomfortable. People would pick me up all the time. They were constantly picking me to be on their teams, that kind of thing. And I could feel the energy and feel the hurt that others were experiencing.
Why was that? Why were you different?
So I'm blonde hair, blue-eyed, Caucasian, I guess the stereotype, and people just thought I was, cute or whatever. I don't know, but they would, constantly, the adults would pick me up no matter what. And I could see the looks on other people's faces. And now I'm recognizing that I have an intuitive quality of being able to sense and feel someone else's emotion and really be in tune with that. And I hadn't developed that at the time, but I could feel it. And it made me feel badly and guilty for getting the attention that I was getting.
So other kids weren't getting that same attention?
Yeah. And I think throughout my life, I was really sensitive to it when it came to my brother, as people would, I'm the baby, and people would refer to my brother as Tiffany's brother rather than my being Chris's sister.
Got it. Well, so you grew up, where did you grow up?
I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area, and I've been able to have the opportunity to move around. I've lived in most different categorizations of how our country is: Midwest, South, Northeast, Pacific, and now I live in the mountain region.
Ah, well, so you you grew up, and I appreciate very much that you were sensitive to how people treated you. So tell me a little bit more about what you thought about that and how that kind of shaped your life and your direction.
Very much so. I think, especially looking back on it, having intentionally studied issues of inequality and bias in my formal studies, looking back on it, I realized that maybe I was coming at it from a different perspective, but I was the one that noticed, I guess. My parents tell me this, that I was the one that noticed when someone was being left out. And the inclusion of different folks just was a part of my life. My best friend growing up was a boy, and that was kind of unusual in and of itself. And he had Japanese American and Jewish American heritage. And that was not anything unusual for me. Mm-hmm. And so, but growing up, even at my wedding, people would point out, oh my gosh, you have the most multicultural wedding party that we've ever seen. And that's just who I am, I guess. And it wasn't until I was able to study it and I found sociology that I got it.
Well, so you spend a lot of time talking about diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging, which is interesting. How did you really come to want to focus your life on dealing with those issues?
I think even as I was in high school, originally you have to choose what you want your major to be. And I wanted to be a physician because that's helping people. And I didn't really have a sense of other careers that could do that. And so I also was doing healthcare administration as my minor, and took a medical sociology class just as an elective. And oh my goodness, that one class changed my life. And I didn't even know sociology existed. I'd never heard of it before. And I was like, wow, I don't have to go to med school to do this. And the this being, I saw a lot of inequalities and was learning more and more about inequalities and bias in the healthcare system, and decided that's the path I wanted to go. And that's where I ended up focusing my graduate work as well.
From a standpoint of intellectual pursuits, I mean, that's certainly understandable, but you've become very emotionally involved. So it goes far beyond just a career path or a learning path. What caused you to be, I think, so emotionally steeped in doing this? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes. So I had the intellectual, and I came to it from the perspective of, for the most part, being in the majority of what we typically research as categories. And then I've had experiences where I was in the minority, and that there were characteristics that actually created barriers for me and my loved ones around me. For example, I was a foster parent and became an adoptive parent to a kiddo who is biracial. And I was already very sensitive to the issues around race and ethnicity and gender. And now I'm living it. I'm not only sensitive and aware as an academic, I'm living it, and living not only from an abstract theoretical level of how to categorize and understand the experience of someone who is in a minority category in multiple categories that overlap. But I'm living trying to help her navigate that. And I'll give you an example. When we went to the airport for the very first time with our kiddo, the person at security taking our IDs and stuff kept asking our kiddo who we were to her. He couldn't understand, not intentionally. He wasn't intentionally trying to have the situation because he was trying to protect the kiddo. But he kept asking her who we were to her, and she didn't understand the question. And after a couple, like multiple times of being asked that, I jumped in and said, he's wanting to know what you call us. And then she said, that's my mommy and daddy. And we even went so far as getting a military ID for her earlier than what kids of military folks tend to get them at, just so we would have some kind of formal identification that demonstrated that she's connected to us.
When you explained what he was asking and she answered him, what was his reaction?
That's a really great question. I know that there was a pause and then he was like, oh, okay. And it seemed to me like he may have been a little bit embarrassed, but was very professional about it. And again, I appreciate anyone who's trying to protect kiddos from trafficking or anything like that. So I think that was the context with which he was asking that question. I was actually more concerned about the reaction my kiddo was having. I was watching her, and because she was really confused, and she was only 5 at the time.
How old is she now?
She's 12 now.
Ah.
Yeah. Between.
Ah, the teenage years cometh soon.
Yeah. And my family and friends have frequently said that situations like that, instead of blowing up, that I give someone a different perspective without trying to do it in a way that's embarrassing or confrontational, I hope is helping to create space for perceiving situations in as accommodating and understanding as possible.
So you've become, by definition, very concerned and interested in the concept of inclusion. What's the difference between diversity and inclusion to you?
To me, measuring diversity is a scientific and theoretical construct of categories. And I often try to think about it in terms of, with diversity, we're trying to measure and monitor areas where there's intentional and unintentional bias or overt discrimination. And you have to create categories by which to do that, to be able to show who's not being treated fairly. And then the issue becomes that we start creating this cycle of, by measuring it, it becomes more real because it's an actual concept that's talked about and becomes a self-perpetuating cycle of, then you are categorizing people in when your work is really trying to uncategorize people, if that makes sense, so that there is less unfair treatment or different treatment. And inclusion, to me, I tend to talk about my work in terms of inclusion. Inclusion for me is a strategy and a philosophy. So the philosophy being, where we are intentional about trying to understand someone else's perspective, noticing who's being left out, who's at the table and being silenced, who's not even thought of to be included in the first place, whose voice is listened to the most. Those are the kinds of things that I tend to engage with. And then there are strategies of inclusion, such as even smiling at someone when you see them, acknowledging them.
Yeah. I think it's interesting. I don't know how this comment fits directly into the model that you described, but I think it does. I have experienced lots of discussions and participated in meetings about diversity over the years. And one of the things that I generally see is, no matter how much discussion we have about diversity, there is at most lip service paid to discussing the concept of diversity, including people with disabilities.
Yes.
And that is a serious problem, because diversity, I think, has, as I put it, been warped to the point where disabilities don't matter in the whole concept of diversity. I've been to councils and conversations and meetings talking about diversity, and disability may be mentioned like once or twice in the course of the day.
Yes.
Why is that?
I don't know, as far as individuals and how they're interacting. I think society,
more as a group. I'm thinking more as a group.
Yeah, I think society in general, which influences group behavior, is the conversations that tend to happen and initially were researched are around race and ethnicity and gender. And that's most people's touches with the concept of diversity. I agree with you that there are a lot of other categories where people are left out and not treated in the same way. And I mean, I can give examples. Sometimes it's because people assume that it's obvious if it's a disability that's visible. And I can give an example in my life. People are always really surprised when I tell them that I have a brain injury, which can be classified as a disability. So sure. the broad range of what disability is. And for me, I even have tried doing initiatives, trying to break the stereotype of the dis part of disability and shifting it to alternate abilities or, you know, different abilities rather than disabilities. And that shift in and of itself is difficult. And I was lucky enough to be able to partner with a former board member of mine who happens to have cerebral palsy. And people assume all the time that she can't think because she is in a wheelchair in a way that she's not as mobile, and she does have trouble verbally articulating. Right. But that doesn't mean that she can't contribute. And that's one of the things, you know, just an example of trying to break through exactly that idea of how people think of what disability is, how people think of what ability is, and diversity.
And that's, I think, the crux of the issue. I have seriously disagreed with the concept of different ability or whatever, because the ability isn't different. Maybe the way we manifest it or the way we cause it to be utilized is different than what most people are used to. For example,
yes,
a person in a wheelchair uses a wheelchair and doesn't yes. walk. But as you point out, ability is what ability is. And so however it manifests it, if you start talking about it as different ability, for example, it kind of covers up the real issue. So I'm all for changing the definition of disability and keeping it, because I haven't come up with something else unless we come up with some whole new word. We've morphed we've totally warped and morphed diversity, and it doesn't tend to be an inclusive term anymore. And I think we need to make sure we don't allow that to happen with the term inclusion. But I think that disability is not as bad a thing if we really say, oh, all that means is that somebody is different than you, but it doesn't mean less. We can change that definition. In the educational system, for example, and in the professional world of blindness, many people have adopted a terminology of you're blind, or you're sight impaired, or you're visually impaired, or you're visually challenged. They're uncomfortable with blind.
Yes.
But I believe that the reality is blindness does not mean a total loss of eyesight. Blindness is a, if you will, term that represents anyone whose eyesight has diminished to the point where they have to use alternatives to using their full normal, well, not normal, but their full eyesight to be able to accomplish things. And if you have to use alternatives and different tools, then you are using the techniques of what a person who is blind ought to use.
Yes.
And so we've got to get over this idea of blind being a bad term. It's the same concept with disability.
Yes, I appreciate that so much. And I appreciate you pushing back and having us really think through even different ability. Right? That's not, that may not be the right terminology either. And obviously it's not perfect, but like you said, sometimes you want to use disability and sometimes it doesn't make a fit. So I love that we have this podcast and the folks that are on it and you out in the world really trying to figure out, okay, well, you know, words matter. And going back to what you had asked me before about why did groups use the categories that they use. And I think part of that has become a save your rear end kind of thing from a legal standpoint.
Yeah.
And also checking boxes to demonstrate that they are paying attention to the categories that are being given to them. And that can be harmful, as we've talked about. It can also be beneficial in that maybe there's not a focus on every group, but maybe by focusing on one group that they're focusing on, my hope is that, and I think the original idea would be that would become part of the culture. That's part of the creation, where then it kind of expands out where more and more people and their different talents and abilities and quirks and personalities all can create better things. I think the issue is that was the ideal of what was intended initially by these frameworks. I think it's gotten stuck in that the more holistic spreading of including more and more people hasn't happened. We've remained stuck in focusing on certain categories.
Yeah, and we tend to like to put people in boxes. We like to put everything in boxes.
Yes.
And the problem is that when we start to do that, no matter who it is, we create limitations that ought not to be there.
Yes.
You're in a box because you're a woman. You're in a box for whatever reason. And society has made decisions about you because of the fact that you're in that box. And yes, we are trying to break down the barriers. What I tend to see with disabilities is that even though next to, it's hard to say that women are a minority since there are actually more women, but you and I know what they mean in terms of
right.
being included in power. Mm-hmm. But next to women, disabilities as a collective sum is the next size minority down from that. The CDC says that 25% of all people have some sort of disability, and I'm sure that's now been affected by COVID.
Oh, yeah.
And we're going to start classifying people somewhere along the line because of how they have been affected by COVID, and some have been very physically affected by COVID. And it is something that we need to deal with. We've got to figure out how to address this issue of stop putting people in so many boxes.
Yeah.
And recognize that we all have gifts and we all ought to be able to use our gifts to their fullest extent.
Yes. Yes, I love that so much. And a couple of, you know, highlights out of what you said is I actually recently wrote a poem and did a Facebook Live, and then I have a different version of it that I'm more than happy to post that talks about the different categories that I know that people see me as, and how even as I read off those categories of checkboxes, how does someone perceive of me and create that mental picture of me as I say those things? And then if I say something that like creates a disjuncture of, oh, that doesn't make sense, that we can start to see, oh my goodness, like subtly, I didn't realize that I was doing that, mm-hmm. right? And I think what you're talking about in terms of inclusion is exactly what I work on in terms of, I see the need for categorization, as we talked about, it can also be very harmful. And for me, I'll go back to kind of what my motto in life is, which is the word ohana. And the word ohana, if anyone has seen Lilo and Stitch, they've heard this quote that ohana means family, and family means no one gets left behind or forgotten.
Right.
Well, that sounds like a great ideal, but how in the world do we do that in reality? And when you look at the actual intention of the Hawaiian people's understanding of this term ohana, in my conversations with some friends that are from Hawaii, they talk about it in terms of community. So mm-hmm. I've started shifting this quote to ohana means community, and community means no one gets left behind or forgotten.
Which is the way it should be.
And I find also that this might be an example that people have said shifts their perspective on even the word family, in that I consider my family, not only my biological family, the family that I married into, but I also include my kiddo's biological family. And there are reasons to have safety measures in some cases, but that doesn't mean that they're left behind or forgotten. I have a personal email that I communicate so that I can tell what's safe or not, and I can pass on that information and be the go-between. But then there's a safety factor, and there's the realistic of, I don't want the connection between biological family and my kiddo to be completely severed, even though in the legal sense it is.
And how is she dealing with all that?
That's shifted over time. Mm-hmm. I'm much more of, I'd rather keep the connection so that there's a relationship there with the understanding that typically kids that are adopted at some point are curious about their biological family and want to learn about them, I'd rather create an environment where it's safe for my kiddo to learn more, but that there's actually more accurate information and that her biological family trusts my spouse and I and understands that we are trying to keep that connection so that when our kiddo's old enough, she can make the decision whether she feels that she could reach out or even possibly do something in person. And some of that has happened over time. There are some family members that we have been able to engage with in person. And there are some that we are trying to bring together. For example, there's a camp that we're trying to bring together the family members that are similar in age to my kiddo together in an environment where all the adults aren't like shaping that, aren't shaping that relationship development, if that makes sense. But it's done in a way that's safe because there's camp counselors that are trained in trauma and have experience in helping develop and nurture those relationships in a camp environment.
It's a process. And
yes.
I think you've verbalized it very well. It clearly is a process, and hopefully she will appreciate the concept of Ohana and internalize it very well going forward when she is older. And of course, as she gets older and becomes more mature, then you're offering the opportunity to make that happen.
And I'd like to, my goal is to, regardless of someone's situation, create environments where that can happen so that connections are fostered in ways that are positive and don't cause harm to either side. And I don't even like the idea of taking sides.
So
in my own statement, I'm like reflecting of like, there's not a side here. You know, I want to understand that people in her family have been through a lot of trauma too, and have not had the opportunities that I've had, and have had significant barriers, which have led to certain traumas, and that's deeply embedded. And I don't want to add another trauma onto that.
That makes sense. I mean, and that is certainly a lofty and ideal goal, and certainly one that makes a lot of sense to do. Sometimes it's hard to be Switzerland, but at the same time, it makes a lot of sense to do that.
Yeah, especially with the dynamic of I am the one in power in this situation to both sides, you know? And at the same time, as I'm trying to be as fair and open-minded and inclusive, my number one priority is the health and safety of my kiddo.
So tell me a little bit more about what you do professionally. What you've graduated from college, you got a doctorate. Now, do you actually, did you get an MD as well?
No, I don't have an MD. And I love that you're asking that question, because people frequently because I focus in medicine and people like, I consider myself a medical sociologist, even though my current work isn't embedded in healthcare or well-being or specific health stuff as it was when I was faculty at a med school. But people will constantly say, you're a doctor, but you're not a doctor. And
love it when they do that?
Yes. And I'm like, I'm a doctor, but I'm not a physician. And that's part of actually identity-wise why I tacked the PhD at the end of my name. And for a while I was, you know, working within DocT PhD specifically because I didn't want there to be a confusion that I was an MD, even though I was doing a lot within medical school and hospitals and community health, those kinds of things.
So no matter what it is, you got to be a doctor. So what else? So what do you do now professionally?
Yes. So my work has really evolved into doing facilitation related to diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. And a lot of that for me is in relation to not necessarily the policy end of things, but more in the application, the real application of creating more inclusive cultures and making those institutionalized in policy and in habit. And one of the things that I'm offering now is to other diversity, equity, and inclusion professionals to provide them with support. And not only do I have this the opportunity within my background to help support someone in that, and I used to be a director of continuous quality improvement, so I bring that aspect, but I'm also a holistic practitioner. So yes, not an MD, but I'm a holistic practitioner. I'm a Reiki master and engage in other holistic techniques as well. So I bridge medical and holistic well-being. And so for me, it's not only moving forward the ideas of diversity, equity, and inclusion and belonging in practice, but really supporting the people who are doing this work, because the work in and of itself is sometimes traumatizing and it's exhausting and high burnout. And we want to move, I personally, and I believe you do too, based on what you've said, is we want to move this movement forward, and we can't afford to lose people who are passionate about trying to move the needle for everyone.
When you say holistic, tell me a little bit more about that, if you would.
Yes. So that also is, I guess, a categorization, trying to help people understand. Some people call it alternative medicine or alternative right. healthcare. And again, the labels go with it. So I'm glad you're asking me. For me, it's, I take the social, all of what I know as a sociologist, and include practices of mind, body, and spirit, recognizing that those individual processes and ways of being are very much affected by the social context, by legislation, by societal culture, by organizational policy, by one-on-one interactions. So all of that is, they're kind of embedded together. And if you only do one piece, which I think is great that there are so many diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging initiatives and professionals and people just volunteering in this realm, that we want to provide the support for them to be able to do that in ways that are positive and not not so reactive, where we're taking care of each other, including taking care of ourselves.
How do you deal with someone you're introduced to or a new person who doesn't necessarily deal with diversity, equity, inclusion, and so on well? How do you break through some of those barriers?
I absolutely love that question. of course, you can see probably a spark in me right now and hear the change in my tone of voice. I love teaching intro to sociology, with the exception of grading, because I think the grading and assignments are actually what prevent people in this realm of trying to see diverse perspectives and practicing doing that. That it gets in the way of that expansion. But part of what I loved is exactly that. People, my students, the majority of them were not interested in sociology, hadn't heard of it, kind of like when I first was introduced, don't care about it, check in a box to graduate. And I've always seen it and tried, and I still do this today, of how can I help someone see things from a different perspective in a way that's non-confrontational and non-judgmental, really trying to understand what's going on in their story that leads them to that belief. And with that, a lot of it is really from in a business or organizational perspective, it's helping teach someone to facilitate a meeting so that everyone's voice is heard equitably, and that even perspectives that you don't believe in are treated without judgment, and finding ways to still add parts of each of those perspectives in moving forward. In an interactional perspective, I've developed a bunch of tools, one of which is where I just have a simple printout card saying, seven things you can do to include someone today. One is smile, one is wave, one is, just send someone a quick text letting them know you're thinking of them, picking up the phone and calling, and not for any purpose other than how are you doing, what's going on with you. Just mm-hmm. that creating that connection. And when there's connection, there's a better opportunity for people to be included. And I really work to have people think intentionally about easier ways to be inclusive, ways that are more practical that you can add in right away.
Yeah. I think we really, as with most things, just need to make the effort and do it, whatever it is. And we tend to allow our perceptions of limitations be the thing that holds us back the most.
Yes. And actually, I'm an example of that I hold myself back. And it's just literally been recently that I've been okay talking about the personal aspects of my life, that where I'm embedded in living in categorizations that are different from the norm. And really even trying to move what we're doing to little kids.
Yeah.
And in the suicide prevention work that I've been a part of, the sense of belonging has become a really big concept. And for me, the sense of belonging is a critical piece. And for someone to have a sense of belonging, someone has to do some kind of action or some kind of connecting where that person is in a situation to feel belong, like they belong.
Yeah. It is a two-way street, right? So it is true that people need to be more open to those who they don't necessarily understand or know. But the other side of it is that those of us who are in the category of people who want to be known and understood need to reach out and try to create an environment where people appreciate and understand and will help then create a welcoming environment. And that may be kind of a circular way of doing it, but the bottom line is we're all on this same earth and need to learn to get along and work together.
Yes. Yeah. And
that's really the big thing.
I mean, even looking in our larger geopolitics, all of that sense of identity, sometimes our sense of identity and the us, them dynamic of how we tend to talk about others creates them as an other and creates that separation. And that obviously, as we're seeing carried out in the world, in our nation, in our communities today, it can have really catastrophic consequences.
What do you do in your professional world to help change that?
That's a really great question. I see the majority of what I do is creating ripples well beyond any interaction that I'm having of helping people develop the skill sets and understanding of someone different from them, seeking out, intentionally seeking out perspectives and cultural activities that are different from them. And that may sound oversimplistic. It's if we're intentional about it, for example, that say you see some type of cultural event going on, maybe go to it and talk with the folks that are attending of why that event's important to them. And culture being a very broad word, of course, for me, that meaning just some kind of difference, right? So seeking out difference, creating connection with people who are different does start to create comfort with difference over time. I guess maybe I have that belief, and maybe that's not a fair belief and too simplistic, but growing up in such a diverse area, being in the DC area, I'm comfortable with difference, and I intentionally seek out people who are different from me to be intentionally. An example, when I started the nonprofit Own Your Own Health, I intentionally put people on the board and invited them, people to be on my board who I knew thought differently and had a different experience than I did, because I wanted them to push me and challenge me, just like we had a little bit earlier in the conversation about, mm-hmm. about the word different. And I'm comfortable with that. And sometimes I'm not comfortable with it, but I know it's important. And so I work through my own discomfort. And luckily, we never had arguments on our board. We had very different perspectives on certain topics, but there was not this animus. And I know that's not as easy to do in some settings. And I, you know, in my own personal life, that's part of why San Francisco is my favorite place I've ever lived, because I didn't feel like I stood out, not in the sense of what I look like, but there's so much diversity in San Francisco on a whole bunch range of issues that's the most comfortable place I've felt, because I didn't feel challenged. I felt that my uniqueness was celebrated
and welcomed.
And welcomed, absolutely. And then when I moved to, you know, back to a location that's in categorization, you know, very Caucasian, the majority of the people have higher education degrees, and I felt really uncomfortable here again.
Mm-hmm.
And even if I fit into those categories, I didn't like that.
Well, maybe God is just trying to help you expand your horizons and recognize that it's not the worst thing in the world to be there either.
Absolutely. It's not. And I know that I'm here for a reason. And if that reason is by interacting with me, that it helps someone see a different point of view, then that's important. And I also feel that especially for people who are in majority categories or, you know, aren't having the same barriers, it's really critical for people in those categories and people who are in power, especially, and have resources in those categories, to be able to say it's important and valuable to support and lift up and include perspectives and people who are different from us.
I think you've given us lots to think about. And I hope that people will go away from this thinking a little bit different about inclusion than maybe they have, and certainly different about diversity. But I hope that people will take away some things to truly think about and intellectualize in their own lives about how maybe they can start to deal with people who are different than they. And you've certainly worked to help create what we call here the concept of the unstoppable mindset, where people believe they can move forward, not only people who are different, but people who may be more in line with what the so-called normal person is, recognizing that in reality, we're all more unstoppable if we work together.
Absolutely.
Well, if people want to reach out to you and learn more about what you do or contact you for whatever reason, how will they do that?
The quickest way would be through LinkedIn, and it's the LinkedIn /IN/DocT. And if you want to schedule a consultation and talk about the situation that you're in and how I might be able to add value to that, that would be through the Proximity platform, and it's prox.io/DocT.
Do you have any courses or books or other things that people can read?
Yes, I have some manuals that I've created. I have some tools that you can use right away. And I have a series of workshops that I've created. One specific workshop that I'm in the second phase of utilizing is one called Repurposing Your Purpose. And that could be for folks that are getting burnt out in their purpose. It could be for folks just starting up initiatives. And of course, I focus on helping people be able to enact and really ignite the purpose that they are here for, to make the world a better place for all.
And how do people get access to that? Is that through the prox.io site or?
Yes, through prox.io. And again, if you want to chat with me or get some of the other downloadable resources, just reach out to me on LinkedIn.
Cool. And again, it's prox.io/DocT.
Yep.
Okay. Well, Tiffany, it has been wonderful to have you here, and I've got lots to go think about. And, you know, every time I do a podcast, I learn things that I get to use in future podcasts, and I don't even necessarily know what they are, but they come up as we go forward. So I really enjoy what you have brought to us today. And I hope that everyone has enjoyed this as much as I have. And we really appreciate you coming on, and hopefully we'll do this again.
Awesome. I so appreciate it. Thank you all for listening. And, you know, for Michael, both you and any of your listeners, I would love to get your thoughts and keep moving my own thinking forward. And, you know, this is great. So I would love to connect.
Let's do it. Would love to. And definitely I want to stay in touch. So let us by all means do that. And again, to all of you who are out there listening, thanks for doing so. Please give us a 5-star rating wherever you are listening to podcasts. And if you would like to comment on this podcast, and I'd love to hear your thoughts, hope you enjoyed it, please feel free to reach out to me. You can email me at michaelhi@accessibe.com. That's Michael H-I, M-I-C-H-A-E-L-H-I, @accessibe.com. And you can also go to our website where we have all the podcast information. It's michaelhingson.com, michaelhingson.com/podcast. So again, Tiffany Noel Brown, thanks for being here. And thank you all for coming and listening to us today.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You have been listening to the Unstoppable Mindset Podcast. Thanks for dropping by. I hope that you'll join us again next week and in future weeks for upcoming episodes. To subscribe to our podcast and to learn about upcoming episodes, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/podcast. Michael Hingson is spelled MichaelHingson. While you're on the site, please use the form there to recommend people who we ought to interview in upcoming editions of the show. And also, we ask you and urge you to invite your friends to join us in the future. If you know of anyone or any organization needing a speaker for an event, please email me at speaker@michaelhingson.com. I appreciate it very much. To learn more about the concept of blinded by fear, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/blinded by fear. And while you're there, feel free to pick up a copy of my free ebook entitled Blinded by Fear. The Unstoppable Mindset Podcast is provided by AccessCast, an initiative of Accessibility, and is sponsored by Accessibility. Please visit www.accessibility.com. Accessibility is spelled AccessiBE. There you can learn all about how you can make your website inclusive for all persons with disabilities and how you can help make the internet fully inclusive by 2025. Thanks again for listening. Please come back and visit us again next week.